Do you agree or disagree with U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder's plan to no longer subject nonviolent drug offenders to mandatory minimum sentences?
By reserving the most severe penalties for serious, high-level, or violent drug traffickers, we can better promote public safety, deterrence, and rehabilitation while making our expenditures smarter and more productive.
Holder announced the plan yesterday, and we'll discuss the implications in this half hour. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 8 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Tuesday, August 13th. And we will welcome your questions and your views for our guest expert at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest is Phil Stinson, assistant professor in the Criminal Justice Program at Bowling Green State University. He worked previously as a police officer, juvenile detention counselor, and an attorney. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for being with us. So the headlines say that federal prosecutors will no longer automatically seek mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent drug offenders. So let's get into a few details here. Which offenders are going to be free from mandatory minimums?
Well, it's going to, if we look at it the other way around, who's not going to be free? If there's a substantial criminal history, in other words, if they have enough points at the time of sentencing, and that's a criteria that the federal probation officer would put together in a pre-sentencing evaluation report, they're going to be excluded, anyone who's got significant criminal histories. If they've used any sort of guns associated with their criminal offenses, their drug offenses, that will exclude a defendant from being relieved of the mandatory minimums. The if there's a death or serious injury that results from their crime, that too would exclude them. Or if they were perceived to be a leader or some sort of organizer of a criminal organization or a gang, that would exclude them. So what we're left with are nonviolent offenders who don't have substantial criminal histories and they're charged with drug offenses in the federal court system. So that's really a potentially a fairly small number, considering that many of the cases that are drug cases in the federal courts involve more serious offenders and more serious crimes. And then a lot of the drug cases are handled through the state courts, so it's not going to have any impact on that at all. And it's not clear at all how the courts are going to perceive this. Is there anything else that's going to come out other than the charging papers that would have quantities of drugs involved so that it would come into play in sentencing? So it's really unclear how a federal court judge necessarily would deal with this, but it really doesn't change a whole lot of what's been in the federal sentencing guidelines in terms of what discretion the U.S. attorneys have in bringing their cases and making charging decisions. And then in that regard, you know, it does raise the question as to whether we're looking at, you know, symbolic politics here. This really is stepping on, potentially, Congress's authority in terms of setting up the laws. And Congress in the late 1980s enacted the federal drug laws that are in place now that deal with the mandatory sentencing. And they've been revised as the crack sentencing in recent years. So it's not clear if this is crime control rhetoric, if it's symbolic politics. And then the other concern I have is that, as the Attorney General mentioned yesterday, there's a real emphasis in the last few years on evidence-based crime prevention, evidence-based practices, evidence-based policies. And this is borrowing from really the public health system, where we look at what works in drug prevention, drug treatment, that type of thing. And we really don't know a whole lot at this point about what works in the way of drug treatment, what works for drug offenders across different communities, across different types of offenses, different ages, different times, different places. We're getting more and more information. And if you look at the Justice Department's website on evidence-based practices, crimesolutions.gov, they do list 15 drug or alcohol programs that have been found to work across, not only across the country, but internationally. And then 29 programs that have been found to be promising. In other words, there have been some studies, but not enough studies to make the decision that they've actually been found to work. But a lot of those programs, that's what, 29 and 15, so what, 40, 39 programs. But a lot of those are alcohol-related programs or drug court programs at the local level that haven't been, evaluated in different settings. So one of the questions that comes up is, okay, but what now? What do we do with these offenders, and who's going to pay for it?
Yeah, well, Jim in Sockville asks, what about those already in prison, presumably the non-violent drug offenders? Will they be released if they are already in jail?
I don't think this impacts on that at all.
Yeah. Well, you're a former police officer, so you they saw a lot of drug offenders in your time. How much of police resources are spent on dealing with going after non-violent offenders?
Well, it's been a long time since I was a police officer, and it was right before or right around the time that the crack epidemic really took off in the late 1980s, early 1990s. It depends on a lot of variables. It depends if we're talking about an urban community, urban policing, rural policing. Even in rural communities, you're dealing with a lot of drug offenders. You're dealing with methamphetamine in a lot of places. You're dealing with heroin in a lot of places because heroin is much cheaper now than cocaine, for example, and it's really taken over as the drug of choice in a lot of communities. So I would say that a good bit of time is dealt with drug offenses, but nonviolent drug offenses, you know, if you're typically not coming across those offenders quite often. So, again, a lot of the concern is it's a public health issue, the drug users that really don't find their way into the criminal justice system as well.
Well, Eric Holder said that in part this was to... Well, maybe it was to reduce the nation's prison population and free up resources to be concentrating on more serious crime and national security. Is this the point of this announcement, of this change in policy?
Well, I think the elephant in the room is that we see this at the state level, definitely across the country as well, that the funding issues, there's a huge cost involved with mass incarceration, and it took us a long time to get to this point in this country where we've really reached a tipping point, not only in the federal system, but in the state systems. If you look at California, what's happened in California, where the federal courts have now come in and mandated that they release huge numbers of prisoners because they're just so overcrowded, and there's a real question as to who's going to pay these costs if we shift it to the county level and to local sheriffs. So there's a lot unknown in that area.
Yeah. How strict are the mandatory minimum sentences anyway?
Well, it depends on the drug. So typically what you're looking at, I think Holder was talking about sentences that are 4 and 5 years, and that we look at the drug offenses are for, let's say, for African Americans, the drug sentences in the federal system tend to be as long or longer than the typical sentences for a white offender in the federal system who's charged with a violent crime. So there really is disparity there. Nobody's questioning the disparities. Nobody's questioning all of the problems that come along with the mandatory minimum sentencing. I don't think that's, it's not even a liberal conservative issue, a left-right issue. There's really consensus across the board, certainly in the criminal justice system in terms of, police and prosecutors and state legislatures and governors across the country. It seemingly coming together, but only because of this tipping point with the fact that, we don't have the money anymore to lock everybody up. It's causing, significant budget problems. And all of this is going to be a problem and potentially fail if we don't take that money and shift it to treatment programs. And you mentioned that one of the things the Attorney General mentioned was focusing not only on serious crime, but on, what did you say, national security issues. Mm-hmm. And to me, that raises some questions as to if we're shifting, the emphasis away because crime is down. What are we really going to be doing with these offenders?
Do you think there is, though, I don't know if I want to call it politics, but public attitudes toward nonviolent drug offenders, have they changed? And are we realizing that there's no need to lock up the nonviolent drug offender for, you know, multiple years.
They've absolutely changed. And one of the reasons for that is if you think back here over the last 20, 25 years, that since the real emphasis on locking up offenders and getting tough on drug crimes, all across the board now, not just in urban communities, not just in African-American families, most people can think now that they know somebody, either a former coworker, a current coworker, a family member, an extended family member, somebody who's actually done time, somebody who's actually been in jail, or somebody who's been in prison. And I think that as we've gotten to that point, you know, it hits a little bit closer to home, that there's a real sort of an understanding now by many more people just in the last few years that it's really taken hold, that we need to look at something else. We really need to focus on drug treatment and prevention programs. And, you know, this just hasn't worked to, you know, to get tough on crime as to the drug offenders. That's the general view.
We are talking about U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder's announcement yesterday that federal prosecutors will no longer seek mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent drug offenders. And we wonder if you support this or not. Do you support more relaxed sentences for nonviolent low-level drug crimes, or do you think that we still need to be tough on drug offenders? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Some say that this shouldn't be up to Eric Holder, that this is something that Congress needs to change. Do you have any thoughts on that? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. Right now we are talking about easing up on sentencing for nonviolent drug crimes, talking about U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder's announcement yesterday that federal prosecutors would no longer insist on the mandatory minimum sentencing for nonviolent drug offenders. And we're talking with a guest expert about what this means, the implications of this announcement. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Phil Stinson. He is an assistant professor in the criminal justice program at Bowling Green State University. Our first caller is Dave in Spring Green. Hello, Dave.
Good morning. The reason I'm calling is that we've got 20 states now that have legalized medical marijuana. And looking at this drug as a recreational drug, it's clearly, objectively safer than what alcohol is. So the mandatory minimum sentencing, dropping those rules, are a good start, but we need to take a much more comprehensive look at how we're handling the drug problems in the country.
What, and talk about legalizing marijuana, Dave?
Absolutely. You know, I spent about 10 years volunteering time with alcoholics and addicts, and was very surprised to see that, you know, there was a lot of people whose life was hanging in the balance, and I never once sat at the bedside of somebody who had smoked marijuana to the point that their life was, you know, in serious jeopardy. So as far as, you know, you look at CDC statistics, and they're showing about 95,000 people a year are dying from excessive use of alcohol, and that there is no statistic for marijuana.
Yeah.
So not only reducing the sentencing, but relooking about how we view this as a recreational substance. It's, you know, there's a market there that we could be producing jobs with.
Well, any comment on that, Professor Stinson?
Yeah, I think you raise a good point, and there again has been a tipping point in that regard. If you look at the Colorado law that went into effect, and there was all sorts of, you know, talk a few years back that the federal government was going to be, the Justice Department was going to be pursuing federal criminal cases against you know, drug dispensaries in Colorado. And one of the realities that they've had to face, and I don't believe they brought any such cases, is that they're potentially going to have a problem with jury nullification. They're not going to get a jury in a federal court in Colorado that's willing to convict in these cases, and they just haven't brought those cases. And because of that, it's led the Attorney General, I think, in great part to where they are now, where there's a shift. So I don't think it's too far down the road that what Dave's talking about is going to be addressed. It's going to have to be addressed at the federal level.
Yeah, so you think this reform is going to mean that marijuana legalization could be down the road?
I don't know about legalization, but potentially criminalization in more state or decriminalization in more states, which is different than legalization. But clearly there's a real shift in the last few years at the state level in many states across the country. But that's not unanimous in all states across the country. But I don't think we're that far away from the federal, from a federal drug policy point of view of having to really take a closer look at that.
Yeah, you did say, though, that the number of federally charged nonviolent drug offenders is probably pretty small. So is this change going to really make a whole lot of difference to the prison population, for example?
No, I don't think it is going to make a whole lot of difference at the federal system, especially because we're not talking about letting anybody out of a federal prison at this point. But, you know, one of the things that could happen here is it shifts the low-level drug cases from the federal system to the state courts. And that's got pros and cons. It's good and bad. Potentially, it's good. You know, as a criminologist, I look at things and think, well, you know what, it's a lot better to have somebody getting treatment for, let's take marijuana out of the picture, but for a drug offender who has a need for drug treatment or a drug offender who would benefit from a crime prevention program of some type to keep them from dealing in illicit drugs. If we move that to the community level with a lot of these offenders, they would do much better and have a much lower recidivism rate potentially if we deal with them without locking them up and putting them in prison, dealing with them at the very local level. But then the downside to that is it's not clear at all that funding is available at the local level to actually implement these treatment programs, and who are going to run these treatment programs? Who are going to staff these treatment programs? Are they on a medical model? I mean, there's a lot that's unknown, and that's what's not been addressed. But so I do question whether this is nothing more than symbolic politics and crime control rhetoric with a completely different spin than we've seen over the last two or three decades. But I think the one thing that could come of this that's good is it's obviously going to have the impact of really sort of forcing or gently pressuring Congress to take a closer look at these issues when they really haven't dealt with this. They've had their head in the sand for a long time on these issues.
Let's go next to Kathleen in Green Bay. Hello, Kathleen.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead, please.
Hi. My comment was this. I have a lot of individuals I know that range from, 18 years old up to in their 70s. And many of them have casual use of drugs, and they also know people who have been put in jail or incarcerated because they've been in the wrong place at the wrong time under the influence of illegal drugs, usually marijuana and things like that. And my observation was that this was long overdue to stop victimizing the people who are using the drugs and focus more on the people who are bringing the drugs in or looking at ways, I agree with the caller or your guest, to work with the population that's victimized them. One of the things I noticed, as an example, living in Wisconsin, there's a phenomenal amount of people who do illegal activities under the influence of alcohol, and that's never factored in to how they're sentenced. But if you find out someone has got any illegal drug in their body, then all of a sudden it's this terrible crime. And I just don't think that it's realistic to put all the blame on the people who are using the drugs for whatever various reasons and make somehow the crimes worse because of just these small factors.
Oh.
And that was just an observation.
Yeah, so that happens that if you, I don't know, rob a bank and you're under the influence of an illegal drug, your sentence is worse, Professor Stinson?
Well, I don't think in that situation you're going to be charged with the drug offense. You're going to, if it's bank robbery is a federal offense, and you're going to be charged with the more serious crime. I don't think they're focusing on Frankly, I've never heard of a bank robber who's under the influence.
Well, yeah, yes, I just made that up as the crime. Yeah. She was saying that you can commit crimes under the influence of alcohol, and it's not enhanced as it is if you're under the influence of other drugs.
Yeah, but the problem here, though, or not the problem, but the scenario that she's pointed out and the offenders that she's talking about anecdotally, I'm not sure that these are offenders that would be in the federal court system looking at federal prison time for drug offenses. So, again, we're back to the point of I'm really not too sure at the federal level how many criminal defendants in drug cases this is really going to impact.
Yeah.
The in drug cases and also in gun cases, there's a lot of back and forth. The federal prosecutors can decide whether they want to take cases from the state court system and prosecute them in the federal system. And there's been a real push in the last year or two where a lot of gun cases are now going into the federal courts. Are we going to really start making that even more so where we're focusing, where the federal courts are focusing, federal prosecutors are focusing on these gun cases as opposed to weapons cases, as opposed to, you know, the drug cases, and really sort of shifting this burden back to the state courts and the state public health systems at figuring out how to come up with treatment mechanisms that are ones that are known to work. And again, you know, we still don't have a whole lot of information in terms of evidence-based crime prevention and drug treatment as to what works.
We'll leave it there. We're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us.
Very good. Take care.
Phil Stinson is an assistant professor in the criminal justice program at Bowling Green State University. He has worked as a police officer, juvenile detention counselor, and an attorney. Thanks to Bill Martins, to Justin Williams, and to Christy Taylor for producing this hour. We'll talk about another criminal justice issue, stop and frisk, coming up after the news.